"I think we can open it now," said Trevise, and using his wrist controls, he tapped out the emission of the radio wave combination that activated the opening mechanism from inside. The lock gaped, and had not opened more than halfway when Trevise said, "Don't dawdle, Janoff. Get inside. Don't wait for the steps. Climb in." Trevise followed, sprayed the rim of the lock with his toned-down blaster. He sprayed the steps, too, once they had lowered. He then signaled the close of the lock and kept on spraying till they were totally enclosed. Trevise said, "We're in the lock, Bliss. We'll stay here a few minutes. Continue to do nothing." Bliss's voice said, "Give me a hint. Are you all right? How is Pell?" Pell said, "I'm here, Bliss, and perfectly well. There's nothing to worry about." "If you say so, Pell. But there'll have to be explanations later. I hope you know that."
"It's a promise," said Trevise, and activated the lock light. The two spacesuited figures faced each other. Trevise said, "We're pumping out all the planetary air we can, so let's just wait till that's done."
"What about the ship air? Are we going to let that in?"
"Not for a while. I'm as anxious to get out of the spacesuit as you are, Janoff. I just want to make sure that we get rid of any spores that have entered with us or upon us." By the not entirely satisfactory illumination of the lock light, Trevise turned his blaster on the inner meeting of lock and hull, spraying the heat methodically along the floor, up and around, and back to the floor. "Now you, Janoff." Pellerat stirred uneasily, and Trevise said, "You may feel warm. It shouldn't be any worse than that. If it grows uncomfortable, just say so." He played the invisible beam over the faceplate, the edges particularly, then, little by little, over the rest of the spacesuit. He muttered, "Lift your arms, Janoff." Then, "Rest your arms on my shoulder and lift one foot. I've got to do the soles. Now the other. Are you getting too warm?" Pellerat said, "I'm not exactly bathed in cool breezes, Golan." "Well then, give me a taste of my own medicine. Go over me."
"I've never held a blaster."
"You must hold it. Grip it so, and with your thumb push that little knob and squeeze the holster tightly." "Right. Now play it over my faceplate. Move it steadily, Janoff. Don't let it linger in one place too long. Over the rest of the helmet, then down the cheek and neck." He kept up the directions, and when he had been heated everywhere and was in an uncomfortable perspiration as a result, he took back the blaster and studied the energy level. "More than half gone," he said, and sprayed the interior of the lock methodically, back and forth over the wall, till the blaster was emptied of its charge, having itself heated markedly through its rapid and sustained discharge. He then restored it to its holster. Only then did he signal for entry into the ship. He welcomed the hiss and feel of air coming into the lock as the inner door opened. Its coolness and its convective powers would carry off the warmth of the spacesuit far more quickly than radiation alone would do. It might have been imagination, but he felt the cooling effect at once. Imagination or not, he welcomed that, too. "Off with your suit now, Janoff, and leave it out here in the lock," said Trevise.
"If you don't mind," said Pellerat, "a shower is what I would like to have before anything else."
"Not before anything else. In fact, before that, and before you can empty your bladder even, I suspect you will have to talk to Bliss." Bliss was waiting for them, of course, and with a look of concern on her face. Behind her, peeping out, was Phelim, with her hands clutching firmly at Bliss's left arm.
"What happened?" Bliss asked severely. "What's been going on?"
"Guarding against infection," said Trevise dryly.
so I'll be turning on the ultraviolet radiation. Break out the dark glasses. Please don't delay. With ultraviolet added to the wall illumination, Trevise took off his moist garments one by one and shook them out, turning them in one direction and another. "Just a precaution," he said. "You do it too, Genoff. And, Bliss, I'll have to peel altogether. If that will make you uncomfortable, step into the next room." Bliss said, "It will neither make me uncomfortable nor embarrass me. I have a good notion of what you look like, and it will surely present me with nothing new."
"What infection?"
"Just a little something that, given its own way," said Trevise with a deliberate air of indifference, "could do a great damage to humanity, I think." 68. It was all done. The ultraviolet light had done its part. Officially, according to the complex films of information and instructions that had come with the Far Star when Trevise had first gone aboard back on Terminus, the light was there precisely for purposes of disinfection. Trevise suspected, however, that the temptation was always there, and sometimes yielded to use it for developing a fashionable tan for those who were from worlds where tans were fashionable. The light was, however, disinfecting, however used. They took the ship up into space, and Trevise maneuvered it as close to Melpomenia's sun as he might without making them all unpleasantly uncomfortable, turning and twisting the vessel so as to make sure that its entire surface was drenched in ultraviolet. Finally, they rescued the two spacesuits that had been left in the lock and examined them until even Trevise was satisfied.
"All that," said Bliss at last, "for moss. Isn't that what you said it was, Trevise? Moss?"
"I call it moss," said Trevise, "because that's what it reminded me of. I'm not a botanist, however. All I can say is that it's intensely green and can probably make do on very little light energy."
"Why very little?"
"The moss is sensitive to ultraviolet and can't grow or even survive in direct illumination. Its spores are everywhere, and it grows in hidden corners, in cracks and statuary, on the bottom surface of structures, feeding on the energy of scattered photons of light wherever there is a source of carbon dioxide." Bliss said,
"I take it you think they're dangerous."
"They might well be. If some of the spores were clinging to us when we entered, or swirled in with us, they would find illumination in plenty without the harmful ultraviolet. They would find ample water and an unending supply of carbon dioxide."
"Only 0.03% of our atmosphere," said Bliss.
"A great deal to them, and 4% in our exhaled breath. What if spores grew in our nostrils and on our skin? What if they decomposed and destroyed our food? What if they produced toxins that killed us? Even if we labored to kill them but left some spores alive, they would be enough, when carried to another world by us, to infest it, and from there be carried to other worlds. Who knows what damage they might do?"
Bliss shook her head. "Life is not necessarily dangerous because it is different. You are so ready to kill."
"That's Gaia speaking," said Trevise.
"Of course it is. But I hope I make sense nevertheless. The moss is adapted to the conditions of this world, just as it makes use of light in small quantities, but is killed by large. It makes use of occasional tiny whiffs of carbon dioxide, and may be killed by large amounts. It may not be capable of surviving on any world but Melpomenia."
"Would you want me to take a chance on that?" demanded Trevise. Bliss shrugged.
"Very well. Don't be defensive. I see your point. Being an isolate, you probably had no choice but to do what you did."
Trevise would have answered, but Phalum's clear, high-pitched voice broke in her own language. Trevise said to Pellerat, "What's she saying?"
Pellerat began, "What Phalum is saying..."
Phalum, however, as though remembering a moment too late that her own language was not easily understood, began again.
"Was there Jemby there where you were?"
The words were pronounced meticulously, and Bliss beamed. "Doesn't she speak Galactic well? And in almost no time." Trevise said in a low voice, "I'll mess it up if I try, but you explain to her, Bliss, that we found no robots on the planet."
"I'll explain it," said Pellerat. "Come, Phalum."
He placed a gentle arm about the youngster's shoulders. "Come to our room, and I'll get you another book to read."
"A book? About Jemby?"
"Not exactly."
And the door closed behind them. "You know," said Trevise, looking after them impatiently, "we waste our time playing nursemaid to that child."
"Waste? In what way does it interfere with your search for Earth, Trevise?"
"In no way. Playing nursemaid establishes communication, however, allays fear, supplies love. Are these achievements nothing?"
"That's Gaia speaking again."
"Yes," said Bliss. "Let us be practical, then. We have visited 3 of the old spacer worlds, and we have gained nothing."
Trevise nodded. "True enough. In fact, we have found each one dangerous, haven't we? On Aurora, there were feral dogs. On Solaria, strange and dangerous human beings. On Melpomenia, a threatening moss. Apparently, then, when a world is left to itself, whether it contains human beings or not, it becomes dangerous to the interstellar community."
"You can't consider that a general rule."
3 out of 3 certainly seems impressive."
"And how does it impress you, Bliss?"
"I'll tell you. Please listen to me with an open mind. If you have millions of interacting worlds in the galaxy, as is, of course, the actual case, and if each is made up entirely of isolates, as they are, then on each world, human beings are dominant and can force their will on non-human life forms, on the inanimate geological background, and even on each other. The galaxy is, then, a very primitive and fumbling and misfunctioning galaxia, the beginnings of a unit. Do you see what I mean?"
"I see what you're trying to say, but that doesn't mean I'm going to agree with you when you're done saying it."
"Just listen to me. Agree or not as you please, but listen. The only way the galaxy will work is as a proto-galaxia, and the less proto and the more galaxia, the better. The Galactic Empire was an attempt at a strong proto-galaxia, and when it fell apart, times grew rapidly worse, and there was the constant drive to strengthen the proto-galaxia concept. The Foundation Confederation is such an attempt. So was the Mule's Empire. So is the empire the Second Foundation is planning. But even if there were no such empires or confederations, even if the entire galaxy were in turmoil, it would be a connected turmoil, with each world interacting, even if only hostily, with every other. That would in itself be a kind of union, and it would not yet be the worst case."
"What would be the worst, then?"
"You know the answer to that, Trevise. You've seen it. If a human-inhabited world breaks up completely, is truly isolate, and if it loses all interaction with other human worlds, it develops malignantly."
"A cancer, then?"
"Yes. Isn't Solaria just that? Its hand is against all worlds, and on it, the hand of each individual is against those of all others. You've seen it. And if human beings disappear altogether,
the last trace of discipline goes. The each against each becomes unreasoning, as with the dogs, or as merely an elemental force, as with the moss. You see, I suppose that the closer we are to Galaxia, the better the society. Why, then, stop at anything short of Galaxia? For a while, Trevise stared silently at Bliss. I'm thinking about it. But why this assumption that dosage is a one-way thing, that if a little is good, a lot is better, and all there is best of all? Didn't you yourself point out that it's possible the moss is adapted to very little carbon dioxide, so that a plentiful supply might kill it? A human being 2 meters tall is better off than one who is 1 meter tall, but is also better off than one who is 3 meters tall. A mouse isn't better off if it is expanded to the size of an elephant. He wouldn't live. Nor would an elephant be better off reduced to the size of a mouse. There's natural size, a natural complexity, some optimum quality for everything, whether star or atom. And it's certainly true of living things and living societies. I don't say the old galactic empire was ideal, and I can certainly see flaws in the Foundation Confederation. But I'm not prepared to say that because total isolation is bad, total unification is good. The extremes may both be equally horrible, and an old-fashioned galactic empire, however imperfect, may be the best we can do. Bliss shook her head. I wonder if you believe yourself, Trevise. Are you going to argue that a virus and a human being are equally unsatisfactory and wish to settle for something in between, like a slime mold? No. But I might argue that a virus and a superhuman being are equally unsatisfactory and wish to settle for something in between, like an ordinary person. There is, however, no point in arguing. I will have my solution when I find Earth. On Melpomenia, we found the coordinates of 47 other spacer worlds. And you'll visit them all? Every one, if I have to. Risking the dangers on each? Yes, if that's what it takes to find Earth. Pellerat had emerged from the room within which he had left Phalum, and seemed about to say something when he was caught up in the rapid-fire exchange between Bliss and Trevise. He stared from one to the other as they spoke in turn. How long would it take? Asked Bliss. However long it takes, said Trevise, and we might find what we need on the next one we visit. Or on none of them. That we cannot know till we search. And now at last Pellerat managed to insert a word. But why look, Golan? We have the answer. Trevise waved an impatient hand in the direction of Pellerat, checked the motion, turned his head and said blankly, What? I said we have the answer. I tried to tell you this on Melpomenia at least 5 times, but you were so wrapped up in what you were doing. What answer do we have? What are you talking about? About Earth. I think we know where Earth is. Part 6. Alpha. Chapter 16. The Center of the Worlds. 69. Trevise stared at Pellerat for a long moment, and with an expression of clear displeasure. Then he said, Is there something you saw that I did not, and that you did not tell me about? No, answered Pellerat mildly. You saw it, and, as I just said, I tried to explain, but you were in no mood to listen to me. Well, try again. Bliss said, Don't bully him, Trevise. I'm not bullying him. I'm asking for information.
and don't you baby him.
Please, said Pellerat, listen to me, will you, and not to each other. Do you remember, Golan, that we discussed early attempts to discover the origin of the human species, Yarif's project? You know, trying to plot the times of settlement of various planets on the assumption that planets would be settled outward from the world of origin in all directions alike. Then, as we moved from newer to older planets, we would approach the world of origin from all directions.
Trevise nodded impatiently. What I remember is that it didn't work because the dates of settlement were not reliable.
That's right, old fellow. But the worlds that Yarif was working with were part of the second expansion of the human race. By then, hyperspatial travel was far advanced, and settlement must have grown quite ragged. Leapfrogging very long distances was very simple, and settlement didn't necessarily proceed outward in radial symmetry. That surely added to the problem of unreliable dates of settlement. But just think for a moment, Golan, of the spacer worlds. They were in the first wave of settlement. Hyperspatial travel was less advanced then, and there was probably little or no leapfrogging. Whereas millions of worlds were settled, perhaps chaotically, during the second expansion, only 50 were settled, probably in an orderly manner in the first. Whereas the millions of worlds of the second expansion were settled over a period of 20,000 years, the 50 of the first expansion were settled over a period of a few centuries, almost instantaneously in comparison. Those 50, taken together, should exist in roughly spherical symmetry about the world of origin. We have the coordinates of the 50 worlds. You photographed them, remember, from the statue. Whatever or whoever it is that is destroying information that concerns Earth either overlooked those coordinates or didn't stop to think that they would give us the information we need. All you have to do, Golan, is to adjust the coordinates to allow for the last 20,000 years of stellar motions, then find the center of the sphere. You'll end up fairly close to Earth's sun, or at least to where it was 20,000 years ago.
Trevise's mouth had fallen slightly open during the recital, and it took a few moments for him to close it after Pellerat was done. He said, "Now why didn't I think of that?"
"I tried to tell you while we were still on Melpomenia."
"I'm sure you did. I apologize, Janov, for refusing to listen. The fact is, it didn't occur to me that..."
He paused in embarrassment.
Pellerat chuckled quietly.
"That I could have anything of importance to say. I suppose that ordinarily I wouldn't, but this was something in my own field, you see. I am sure that, as a general rule, you'd be perfectly justified in not listening to me."
"Never," said Trevise. "That's not so, Janov. I feel like a fool, and I well deserve the feeling. My apologies again, and I must now get to the computer."
He and Pellerat walked into the pilot room, and Pellerat, as always, watched with a combination of marveling and incredulity as Trevise's hands settled down upon the desk, and he became what was almost a single-man computer organism.
"I'll have to make certain assumptions, Janov," said Trevise, rather blank-faced from computer absorption. "I have to assume that the first number is a distance in parsecs, and that the other two numbers are angles in radians, the first being up and down, so to speak, and the other right and left. I have to assume that the use of plus and minus in the case of the angles is galactic standard, and that the 000 mark is Melpomenia's sun."
"That sounds fair enough," said Pellerat.
"Does it?"
There are 6 possible ways of arranging the numbers. 4 possible ways of arranging the signs. Distances may be in light years rather than parsecs. The angles in degrees rather than radians. That's 96 different variations right there. Add to that the point that if the distances are light years, I'm uncertain as to the length of the year used. Add also the fact that I don't know the actual conventions used to measure the angles, from the Melpomenean equator in one case, I suppose. But what's their prime meridian?
Pellerat frowned.
No, you make it sound hopeless.
Not hopeless. Aurora and Solaria are included in the list, and I know where they are in space. I'll use the coordinates and see if I can locate them. If I end up in the wrong place, I will adjust the coordinates until they give me the right place, and that will tell me what mistaken assumptions I am making as far as the standards governing the coordinates are concerned. Once my assumptions are corrected, I can look for the center of the sphere.
With all the possibilities for change, won't it make it difficult to decide what to do?
What? Said Trevise. He was increasingly absorbed. Then, when Pellerat repeated the question, he said, Oh, well, chances are that the coordinates follow the galactic standard, and adjusting for an unknown prime meridian isn't difficult. These systems for locating points in space were worked out long ago, and most astronomers are pretty confident they even antedate interstellar travel. Human beings are very conservative in some ways, and virtually never change numerical conventions once they grow used to them. They even come to mistake them for laws of nature, I think, which is just as well. For if every world had its own conventions of measurement that changed every century, I honestly think scientific endeavor would stall and come to a permanent stop. He was obviously working while he was talking, for his words came haltingly. And now, he muttered. But quiet now. After that, his face grew furrowed and concentrated, until, after several minutes, he leaned back and drew a long breath. He said quietly, The conventions hold. I've located Aurora. There's no question about it. See? Pellerat stared at the field of stars and at the bright one near the center and said, Are you sure?
Trevise said, My own opinion doesn't matter. The computer is sure. We've visited Aurora, after all. We have its characteristics, its diameter, mass, luminosity, temperature, spectral details, to say nothing of the pattern of neighboring stars. The computer says it's Aurora.
Then I suppose we must take its word for it.
Believe me, we must.
Let me adjust the view screen and the computer can get to work. It has the 50 sets of coordinates, and it will use them one at a time.
Trevise was working on the screen as he spoke. The computer worked in the 4 dimensions of space-time routinely, but for human inspection, the view screen was rarely needed in more than 2 dimensions. Now, the screen seemed to unfold into a dark volume, as deep as it was tall and broad.
Trevise dimmed the room lights almost totally to make the view of starshine easier to observe.
It will begin now, he whispered.
A moment later, a star appeared, then another. The view on the screen shifted with every addition so that all might be included. It was as though space was moving backward from the eye, so that a more and more panoramic view could be taken. Combine that with shifts up or down, right or left. Eventually, 50 dots of light appeared, hovering in 3-dimensional space.
Trevise said, I would have appreciated a beautiful spherical arrangement, but this looks like the skeleton of a snowball that had been patted into shape in a big hurry
out of snow that was too hard and gritty.
Does that ruin everything?
It introduces some difficulties, but that can't be helped, I suppose. The stars themselves aren't uniformly distributed, and certainly habitable planets aren't, so there are bound to be unevennesses in the establishment of new worlds. The computer will adjust each of those dots to its present position, allowing for its likely motion in the last 20,000 years. Even in that time, it won't mean much of an adjustment. And then fit them all into a best sphere. It will find a spherical surface, in other words, from which the distance of all the dots is a minimum. Then we find the center of the sphere. And Earth should be fairly close to that center. Or so we hope. It won't take long. 70. It didn't. Trevise, who was used to accepting miracles from the computer, found himself astonished at how little time it took. Trevise had instructed the computer to sound a soft reverberating note upon deciding upon the coordinates of the best center. There was no reason for that, except for the satisfaction of hearing it, and knowing that perhaps the search had been ended. The sound came in a matter of minutes, and was like the gentle stroking of a mellow gong. It swelled till they could feel the vibration physically, and then slowly faded. Bliss appeared at the door almost at once.
"What's that?"
she asked, her eyes big.
"An emergency?"
Trevise said, "Not at all." Pellerat added eagerly, "We may have located Earth, Bliss. That sound was the computer's way of saying so." She walked into the room.
"I might have been warned."
Trevise said, "I'm sorry, Bliss. I didn't mean it to be quite that loud." Phelim had followed Bliss into the room and said,
"Why was there that sound, Bliss?"
"I see she's curious, too," said Trevise. He sat back, feeling drained. The next step was to try the finding on the real galaxy, to focus on the coordinates of the center of the spacer worlds, and see if a G-type star was actually present. Once again, he was reluctant to take the obvious step, unable to make himself put the possible solution to the actual test.
"Yes," said Bliss. "Why shouldn't she? She's as human as we are."
"Her parent wouldn't have thought so," said Trevise abstractedly. "I worry about the kid. She's bad news."
"In what way has she proven so?" demanded Bliss.
Trevise spread his arms. "Just a feeling." Bliss gave him a disdainful look and turned to Phelim.
"We are trying to locate Earth, Phelim." "What's Earth?"
"Another world, but a special one. It's the world our ancestors came from. Do you know what the word ancestors means from your reading, Phelim?"
"Does it mean..."
But the last word was not in Galactic. Pellerat said, "That's an archaic word for ancestors, Bliss. Our word forebears is closer to it." "Very well," said Bliss, with a sudden brilliant smile. "Earth is the world where our forebears came from, Phelim. Yours and mine, and Pell's and Trevise's."
"Yours, Bliss? And mine also?"
Phelim sounded puzzled.
"Both of them?"
"There's just one set of forebears," said Bliss. "We had the same forebears, all of us." Trevise said, "It sounds to me as though the child knows very well that she's different from us." Bliss said to Trevise in a low voice,
"Don't say that. She must be made to see she isn't, not in essentials."
"Hermaphrodism is essential, I should think."
I'm talking about the mind.
Transducer lobes are essential, too.
Now, Treviz, don't be difficult. She's intelligent and human, regardless of details.
She turned to Phelim, her voice rising to its normal level. Think quietly about this, Phelim, and see what it means to you. Your forebears and mine were the same. All the people on all the worlds, many, many worlds, all had the same forebears. And those forebears lived originally on the world named Earth. That means we're all relatives, doesn't it? Now, go back to our room and think of that. Phelim, after bestowing a thoughtful look on Treviz, turned and ran off, hastened on by Bliss's affectionate slap on her backside. Bliss turned to Treviz and said,
Please, Treviz, promise me you won't make any comments in her hearing that will lead her to think she's different from us.
Treviz said, I promise. I have no wish to impede or subvert the educational procedure. But, you know, she is different from us.
In ways, as I am different from you, and as Pell is.
Don't be naive, Bliss. The differences in Phelim's case are much greater.
A little greater. The similarities are vastly more important. She and her people will be part of Galaxia someday, and a very useful part, I'm sure.
All right. We won't argue. He turned to the computer with clear reluctance. And meanwhile, I'm afraid I have to check the supposed position of Earth in real space.
Afraid?
Well, Treviz lifted his shoulders in what he hoped was a half-humorous way. What if there's no suitable star near the place?
Then there isn't, said Bliss.
I'm wondering if there's any point in checking it out now. We won't be able to make a jump for several days.
And you'll be spending them agonizing over the possibilities. Find out now. Waiting won't change matters.
Treviz sat there with his lips compressed for a moment, then said, You're right.
Very well, then. Here goes.
He turned to the computer, placed his hands on the hand marks on the desk, and the view screen went dark.
Bliss said, I'll leave you then. I'll make you nervous if I stay.
She left with a wave of her hand.
The thing is, he muttered, that we're going to be checking the computer's galactic map first, and even if Earth's sun is in the calculated position, the map should not include it. But we'll then...
His voice trailed off in astonishment as the view screen flashed with a background of stars. These were fairly numerous and dim, with an occasional brighter one sparkling here and there, well scattered over the face of the screen. But quite close to the center was a star that was brighter than all the rest.
We've got it, said Pellerat jubilantly. We've got it, old chap. Look how bright it is.
Any star at centered coordinates would look bright, said Treviz, clearly trying to fight off any initial jubilation that might prove unfounded. The view, after all, is presented from a distance of a parsec from the centered coordinates. Still, that centered star certainly isn't a red dwarf, or a red giant, or a hot blue-white. Wait for information. The computer is checking its databanks. There was silence for a few seconds, and then Treviz said, Spectral class G2. Another pause, then. Diameter, 1.4 million kilometers. Mass, 1.02 times that of Terminus's sun. Surface temperature, 6,000 absolute. Rotation, slow, just under 30 days.
No unusual activity or irregularity.
Pellerat said, "Isn't all that typical of the kind of star about which habitable planets are to be found?"
"Typical," said Treves, nodding in the dimness. "And therefore what we'd expect Earth's sun to be like. If that is where life developed, the sun of Earth would have set the original standard."
"So there is a reasonable chance that there would be a habitable planet circling it."
"We don't have to speculate about that," said Treves, who sounded puzzled indeed over the matter.
"The galactic map lists it as possessing a planet with human life, but with a question mark."
Pellerat's enthusiasm grew.
"That's exactly what we would expect, Golan. The life-bearing planet is there, but the attempt to hide the fact obscures data concerning it and leaves the makers of the map the computer uses uncertain."
"No, that's what bothers me," said Treves. "That's not what we should expect. We should expect far more than that.
Considering the efficiency with which data concerning Earth has been wiped out, the makers of the map should not have known that life exists in the system, let alone human life. They should not even have known Earth's sun exists. The spacer worlds aren't on the map. Why should Earth's sun be?"
"Well, it's there just the same. What's the use of arguing the fact? What other information about the star is given?"
"A name."
"Ah, what is it?"
"Alpha."
There was a short pause, and then Pellerat said eagerly,
"That's it, old man. That's the final bit of evidence. Consider the meaning."
"Does it have a meaning?" said Treves. "It's just a name to me, and an odd one. It doesn't sound galactic."
"It isn't galactic. It's in a prehistoric language of Earth, the same one that gave us Gaia as the name of Bliss's planet."
"What does Alpha mean, then?"
"Alpha is the first letter of the alphabet of that ancient language. That is one of the most firmly attested scraps of knowledge we have about it. In ancient times, Alpha was sometimes used to mean the first of anything. To call a sun Alpha implies that it's the first sun. And wouldn't the first sun be the one around which a planet revolved that was the first planet to bear human life? Earth?"
"Are you sure of that?"
"Absolutely," said Pellerat.
"Is there anything in early legends, you're the mythologist after all, that gives Earth's sun some very unusual attribute?"
"No, how can there be? It has to be standard by definition, and the characteristics the computer has given us are as standard as possible, I imagine, aren't they?"
"Earth's sun is a single star, I suppose."
Pellerat said, "Well, of course. As far as I know, all inhabited worlds orbit single stars."
"So I would have thought myself," said Treves.